Hello, and welcome to the new Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Frame.io. My name is Steve Hallfish. I'm a feature film and documentary editor. For more than 7 years, over 300 interviews, I've been speaking with my colleagues in film, TV, and docs about the art and craft of editing. Today, we're speaking with multi-Oscar nominee Hank Corwin, ACE, about editing Adam McKay's film, Don't Look Up. Hank's been winning editing awards for 25 years. He was nominated for an Ace Eddie for editing The Horse Whisperer. He won or was nominated for many awards for his editing on The Tree of Life. He was nominated for an Oscar and a BAFTA and won an Ace Eddie for his brilliant work on The Big Short, and was nominated for an Oscar and an Ace Eddie and won a BAFTA for his editing of the movie Vice. I last interviewed him ahead of that win in 2019. His other work includes The Legend of Bagger Vance, Nixon, and Natural Born Killers, and work as an additional editor on films like JFK, Public Enemies, Moneyball, and Ad Astra. If you're interested in reading this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to blog.frame.io, where there's a ton of great expert content for film professionals of all types. I want to start out talking a little bit about some things that I saw in the movie that I just loved. The opening close-ups, right? You don't start this movie about this gigantic earth-shattering event with a huge exterior of the telescope. That would be like the obvious way to go, right? No, you went small, which I loved. Talk to me a little bit about those choices.
Yeah, no, guys, they say God is in the details.
Amen.
I mean, this is a movie about unimaginable catastrophe, and it starts with the sound of a tea kettle, just a tiny shot of hot water being poured into a cup. And I just love the intimacy.
And the other thing that I noticed about the beginning is no score, right? You just use sound effects.
I'm so glad that you picked up on that, Steve. Yeah, absolutely. There's no music, no narration. It was just natural. And it just went on and on, and only, and even the score that starts in, it's almost subliminal. I never like score that motivates your feelings. I try to make score as being almost a component of the picture. I try to cut this thing like a collage, and the score is definitely, it's got the same value as the picture. I could have like had this grandiose discovery. I just loved the intimacy of it and how personal it was. It's the only time where Jen Lawrence's character is happy in the entire movie. It was joyful, and I just wanted to internalize it for her.
Talk to me about deciding when to place that cue, when to have that cue start.
It actually starts very, very, very quietly under the telescope when the laser sight is turned on into the stars. You know that I love the cacophony of sounds. She's singing a Wu-Tang song, and I've got the score fighting it. And it's just because it's the synergistic thing. It just, Nikki's score, Nick Bertel's score, is part of what made her even a little more human. And that fighting of her singing in the score.
Another thing I loved is she's realizing something bad's going to happen. She goes to her professor, kind of, they talk about it. And then when his realization happens, he just says, "Kate, you stay," and you cut to black. Talk to me about that decision.
It's interesting because I had other shots. It's almost like using like phrases as opposed to sentences.
I interviewed a documentary editor who said that the narration in the documentary had to be haiku. And I thought that was perfect, right? It's not a big elaborate poem. It's this quick, short little thoughts.
I totally respect that. You know, years ago, Steve, when I was just starting out, I was in my early 20s, and I worked for this commercial film editor. We were working on film at the time, and I would reconstitute his trims. Say if it was a serial commercial, the seminal part of the shot might be where the guy is bringing the spoon up to his mouth. I would splice the piece before, you know, where he's thinking about it, or where he doesn't know the camera's on him, or afterwards, where he's feeling satisfied. None of this a normal editor would want to use. And what I found when I joined these things, it was another way of communicating. It became this new language for me of editorial. unbeknownst to me, German Impressionists were doing it in the 20s. I always try to work with subtext, as we've discussed. And I find that sometimes the purest form of communication on film is to have an action and to have light and then to have the absence of light. That's what the cut to black does. If you were eating sushi, it would be the ginger that clears your palate.
Great analogy. I love that. On the revelation of what's about to happen to the government, you start doing jump cuts, which we have not seen up till now. And there's also flash forwards and flashbacks. Talk to me a little bit about the decision to use those.
What I wanted to do was create this sense of discomfort. You know, we've been almost classical before that in the editorial. I wanted to disrupt brain chemistry. You know, I think we're now visually sophisticated enough to be viewing certain scenes on different times and in different realities. I figured by doing that, not only would I be able to move through something faster, but I was making the tension much more apparent. It was a device that I used just to heighten the tension and the anxiety.
I love those choices. They're bold. And as you said, it changes your brain chemistry.
The thing is, in the last two reels of the film, the last 20 minutes become very contemplative and beautiful and terrifying, you know, and in order to make those really work, I just had to build the anxiety and the acceleration of what was going on in order to be able to have that release when they discover the comet in the night sky. You know, when I cut these things, and you and I have discussed this before, I liken it to cutting in a collage form as opposed to montage. I may use a sound, I may use an image that won't have resonance for another 5 minutes or 20 minutes or half an hour later. So it becomes a question of tone, you know, and it's like playing this crazy chess game. It's in different dimensions. So you're constantly refining and revising.
As you were saying, a lot of some of that stuff allowing you to jump forward and accelerate the pace, but you also held on things like the moment when they step off the plane in DC, there's this hold of them getting off the plane. You could just, the plane hits the skids and the next thing you know, they're in an office someplace, but no, there's this moment. Why hold on that section of them getting off that gigantic plane?
Throughout the film, I have moments where we freeze. And they almost become postcards of a reality, just a scrapbook that gets launched into the universe of what humans were like in separate moments, you know, either when they were really anxious, where they were very loving and very joyful. In the launch, we have moments where I freeze and moments of great joy. It was like a catalog of emotion, you know, told in these stills. I find stills coming off of a moving image can be extremely powerful, especially as an editor. If you don't just freeze a frame, but you jump ahead even 10 frames, you know, so it's jarring to the eye. But again, it's a matter of affecting brain chemistry.
Was the moment to cut to the opening credits, was that scripted or was that something you guys found in the...
You know what? I give all credit to Adam K. I mean, he's the guy that came up with the credits in the middle of Vice. And that's something I really want to emphasize. I mean, the guy is the best partner I could have. Every editor should have an Adam McKay in their life at least once.
Is there an advantage or a difficulty in working with a director that has also written the screenplay?
No, because he's very clear. I mean, sometimes he's so clear that it's a little uncanny. I can't do my voodoo moves on the guy because he knows what he wants. He wrote it, damn it. It's wonderful. But whenever I'm cutting, I mean, I love just talking metaphorically with the director about what he's trying to say. And Adam just knows exactly what it is that he wants on so many different levels.
How does he communicate with you? Is it more like an actor?
No, you know, he's sitting behind me, he grunts and throws Nicorette at me. No, you know, honestly, I'll be really honest. It's actually very Socratic. You know, we ask each other questions. He's sucking on his Nicorettes because he's trying to quit smoking always. And we get into it. Sometimes, say, if I'm looking for a piece of music, he'll just jump onto his iPhone and find some music. And more often than you'd expect, he's right.
Let's talk about the scene where Jennifer Lawrence's character, Leonardo DiCaprio's character, a couple other people are waiting around for the president to grant them an audience. That's pretty obvious to any editor, like why you would be in that scene to drag it out. You know, you're trying to make a point. You're trying to increase the tension. How do you decide when enough is enough?
Oh my God, Steve. Adam told me initially, it's one of the few times when he became prescriptive. He said, I want the scene to be really long. And I said, Adam, it's going to be boring. And he told me, it's like, I want people to feel boredom. I try to explain to him that that's not the right kind of boredom. We started out by cutting the scene very long and it was boring. And ultimately he saw the error of his ways. You know, the thing is, at least with the way I cut, there's no one way. We experimented. We had much more material. Everyone's improvising. You've got all these characters who are some of the great living actors, you know, so I have plenty of material, you know, so it just became an exercise in letting go of great moments. Each time I got rid of something, it was like a little death. Mm. I think the French call it a petit mort. It's like, it's an orgasm.
I was going to say that that's what that meant, but yeah, I'm glad you filled that in.
This evolves into a longer conversation about how he shot this film and how the actors improvised. Adam gives them great freedom. Obviously, they cover a script, but they're all fantastic. Say the scene with the first Oval Office scene, you had, well, these great, great actors in a room for 2 days, and they're running between 4 and 6 cameras, and you just have to ascertain what's going to work, what's not going to work. And ultimately, you don't know. I didn't know until my cut would be an hour down the line. Either we started feeling fatigue or things felt a little bit too light or slapstick even. Then, you know, if we made the film too dark, it would really resonate throughout. And then the film would become really operatic. At one time, I'd wanted to make an opera out of this thing. I'm not a funny guy. I don't come from the funny world. And I wanted, and Nick Bertel wanted to make it into, I mean, it's a great tragedy. And we were talking about making this film into an opera.
Same script, same performances, but just different choices of tone.
Absolutely. The pursuit of tone was perhaps the most difficult part of cutting this film. And knowing that there was no one way and knowing that you wouldn't know how the tone was really working until you were at the end of the film. It became a laborious process. And there were times when it became a little bit overwhelming for me as an editor.
Yeah, I'm sure, especially when talking about the amount of cameras and footage and, well, I mean, just the choice of, like you said, the choices that you have to make in tone, because you can take the film in a totally different direction, and then how do you get it back?
Well, I think Adam, on one of his comedies, I think he cut a completely alternate version of the picture. I think it was Talladega Nights. I'm not sure. You know, so he shoots that much material. He engenders such wonderful feelings with his actors and such loving trust that they feel very comfortable giving performances that perhaps they might not to other directors.
You mentioned the amount of improvisation that is in there. What are the challenges of working with improvised material?
Well, with these actors, it's just there's such a plethora and there's such a gamut of performances. You may choose a piece of improv and you're not going to know that it's not working until you're into the film for another 35 minutes. So you're constantly refining and fine-tuning the tone and the colors and the emotional colors of the film.
Can you give an example of how choosing a certain improv would be something you don't find out, oh, I shouldn't have chosen that line until later?
Again, in that first Oval Office scene, initially, I cut a hilarious scene that was 16 minutes long. It was fantastic. But the thing is, it was so funny, it lost its credibility. And one of the fine lines we had to walk was just making these performances real enough so conceivably these things could be happening. People could be saying these things. You know, because if performances became too broad, I think we'd lose the movie, especially with Jonah. I mean, the guy just breathes comedy. And also, he affected Meryl. She had a hard time keeping a straight face sometimes.
And then she probably wants to improvise and be funny too. And then,
oh no, absolutely. And I'm sure for her, it was like this whole existential plight. It's like, this is what it's come down to. I'm playing the president of the United States and Jonah Hill is my son. And I've got to make this thing seem somewhat real. And McKay comes in, who truly is the king of comedy. And he was like Attila the Hun, having me strip out funny moments. You know, with great regularity, a director rips out the heart of their editor. And he was no exception.
I thought you were going to say rips out the heart of the film, but no, rips out the heart of the editor.
Well, no, at least, you know, I wear my heart on my sleeve, you know, so it's a pretty easy target. You know, and again, I've got my subtext. In my subtext, this thing isn't a comedy. You know, nobody will ever know that except the bunch of nerdy editors that listen to this podcast.
There's a liberal use of insert shots. A lot of times with maybe a less accomplished director, a cheaper budget, a less accomplished editor, you'd see those insert shots because, oh, I need to cover something that I can't cover because of continuity or something. But you've got six cameras running, great actors, 2 days worth of performance. There's no need to cut to those unless it's a conscious choice, a decision to make a statement.
For sure. I've got continuity up the ass, really. It's like, and you know, I've told you, continuity's for sissies anyway. I hate continuity.
You and Thelma and about 100 other editors that I know, yep. One of the other moments that I really loved was the choice of Jennifer's boyfriend understands what's about to happen. He's out on the street of New York and they're walking. You cut to inside of a restaurant looking back out and the sound goes away.
I will take full credit for that. No, you go inside and you're hearing Muzak. It's the way the world is. You know, what I'm trying to do is show this film in a very experiential way. We're observing them. It could be someone else is observing them. It could be them observing each other or even themselves. I just thought it was a playful way to just show. I mean, he's melting down on the street and inside it's this insipid little moment. And I just love that because that's the way life is.
You talked about collage, which I love that description as opposed to montage. There's a bunch of shots at various moments throughout the film where you cut to kind of nature. Talk to me about the purpose of those and why you used them and when they went in.
Truth is always like this tiny flow into this massive river of media. It's truly, it's Hades. It's the river Styx. It's a river of shit, if you were into Dante. And the truth exists there somewhere. It goes out and we try to show all the social media. And I think we represented it pretty well. But what I wanted to do, ultimately for me, I started feeling really unclean. I thought that as someone who was putting this together, I had to go back to these little touchstones of truth. And when you see single-celled organisms moving around, there's no bullshit there. They are. They just are. When an ocean wave is pounding a rock, it just is. There's no interpretation. There's no bullshit. And then ultimately, I tried to show like living organisms. You know, it's like we're all guided by like our limbic brains, where you have these subconscious motivations. You can have a human mother with a baby, with a child. You can have a hippo with a baby. It's the same drive. I think in order to articulate it, I just had to show different species. They become metaphors for us and for like this overarching intelligence.
I felt like it was a little bit showing kind of evolution and the end of the world and how these things, extinction is kind of how I felt.
The thing is, again, we have different layers of reality. That is absolutely what I was trying to show.
Love it. What are some other story pacing things where you felt like we need to get to this point in the movie sooner? Were there any of those things that you felt like the movie is the movie and that's fine, but this section of the movie is too long or too short?
we had a number of those sections, and you can't really tell until the film is together. Going to the very first launch, you're showing Leonardo's character on the ascendancy. He's becoming a man full of himself, and he's becoming an emperor. And then at the same time, you're showing Jennifer Lawrence, who represents the truth and reality and humaneness. She's getting beaten up. I was playing with that arc, and obviously these guys are such fantastic actors, and I had these moments go on much longer, and they were much more poignant. But I found that by the time we get to the launch, the first launch, and the little girl sings the 23rd song, it's like it flattened the new chapter. And I didn't know this for a couple of months. I just knew. It's like, wow, this should be propulsive. And everything is feeling very slowed down. There's something wrong here. I had to go back and just keep pulling stuff out. And I work very closely with Adam.
There's a really interesting moment where it's a point in the hotel hallway with Leo, and the score is just screaming along, or it might be a music drop. And then when they talk, the music literally cuts out and cuts back in.
They're pawing at each other, and I forget exactly what she says. It's like,
I think she says, "Tell me we're all going to die."
Tell me we're all going to die. And, you know, he's a scientist from Lansing, Michigan. He's in over his head. And so ultimately he says, "We're all going to die." And she goes, "Oh," right. And he says, oh my God. And I just wanted to clear that out just to show the comedy and the delicateness of their relationship. The music and the absence of music became a device to accentuate that. Because Adam years ago told me that he hated fart jokes. You know, he's a consummate comic. Fart jokes are too easy. And I thought he might feel the same way, but I got it past him.
There's one of the things I thought was really interesting was that there's very few indications of how much time we have left.
We didn't want to do that. You know, you have her diet app, and I think we go to it once or twice. Once, I think. When you go back to the natural world, when you go back to the people crossing the street in Japan in the Shibuya district and the insects, in a way that shows a passage of time. Without having to be too obvious. I think everybody has their own separate rhythms. I don't want to enforce it with something that's artificial like that. It's not truthful. I thought the story and the communication was so much bigger than that. That's like literal continuity, and I just didn't want to go there.
There's an interesting scene in a TV studio, and Leo is just losing it. He is freaking out, and there's reverb on his voice. It sounds like he's in an echoey room. Is that something that was applied? Did you feel like it was needed? Did they record it that way intentionally, or was that something added?
Our mixer, Chris Scarabasio, just put it in. It's very subtle, just to sharpen the moment. I mean, it was a great idea. I hadn't thought of it, and it worked really well.
That scene seemed really like Network, Sidney Lumet, that had that moment to it. Did you guys think about that? Did you watch Network?
The thing is, obviously, the film is similar to Network, and the film is similar to Strangelove, but not exactly the same as either of them. It's a great compliment to be compared to those scenes, as long as people think we did a good job, you know, because it's like those two films are very high bars.
In the movie, there's a point where the president says, "I have to tell the people something." And so they're planning it out, and you're intercutting between the plan and the actual delivery and going back and forth. As scripted or something you found in
it? Yeah, no, Adam had scripted most of that. And I thought it worked really well. It became a comedic device. You know, there would be this repetitive nature when the president or her son would be saying something, and then you'd go onto the battleship and Ron Perlman would be repeating it. It was just a fantastic device. And then from there, it was that anxiety-inducing editorial that launches us into the news and social media montage and collages.
You had choices to do time jumps. Like, I remember when Leo's on the set of The Rip, Dr. Mindy, he's being asked a question, and you cut to him getting made up for the interview and then cut back to him on set. Talk to me about the reason for doing that. Why would you cut backwards in time and then come back to where you were?
I found if you look at his expression, it's so wise and so tragic and so world weary. You know, he's contemplating what he's got to do. And I just thought it was a great way to keep reminding the viewer that as opposed to watching him when he goes into his rant, it becomes much more experiential when you're just looking at this close-up where the guy is just so full of tragedy and sadness.
I want to talk about maintaining energy, especially between scenes, cutting from one scene to another. To do these hard cuts in the middle of a conversation or a song that, you know, is going on in the scene, and instead of waiting for someone to finish their sentence or finish a thought, you're cut in the middle of a song, in the middle of a conversation, to go to the next scene. I think of that as a way to maintain energy. If you wait to the end, then the scene comes to a conclusion and you've got to start the energy up again.
You have traditionally scenes that have a beginning, a middle, and an ending. I find that many times you don't need the beginning or the ending, because that's just the way life is. You walk into a room and people are in the middle of a conversation, or you walk out of a room, you don't hear the end of it, but you're thinking about it. Sometimes even you almost want to go back into the room because you might have missed something. I think it's actually it's a very muscular way to cut, to pull scenes forward. What I'd love to do is have a really lyrical film and have moments like that. This isn't exactly lyrical until the ending. There's some wonderful filmic devices that you can use that I'd love to try in new forms.
The end of the film ends beautifully. It's a wonderful tonal moment, but very different than a lot of the rest of the film. How did you get to that point of switching to this tonal point in the film where it ends?
You know, what's funny, Steve, is that's the way I always saw the film. You know, that was the film for me. I knew that that's where I wanted to go, you know, and I knew after all the bathos and all the mirth and the frivolity, that's where I wanted to go. It was the most natural thing for me. It became operatic and just so poignant. And that's, again, it was the payoff for everything else.
Did it require a change in some kind of transition?
The transition actually came when they see the comet in the night sky for the first time. And the music becomes, I'm mixing George Strait, and Nick made this track that was almost liturgical. And I mixed them together and it became haunting and almost like quasi-religious. That's where the movie changed. So by the time we got to the end of the film, it was as it should be.
Love that. Hank, thank you so much for a brilliant discussion. I really love hearing your insights into editing.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure, Steve.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, these interviews are available to read at blog.frame.io, where they're supported with great visual content, images, video clips, and more. It's a great opportunity to check out the other expert content on the blog for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven, curated look at the art and craft of editing. And be on the lookout for our upcoming video interview with legendary editor Paul Hirsch, ACE, on our YouTube channel. Thanks again to my guest, Hank Corwin, ACE. Thanks to Dylan Giovanetto for editing today's podcast using Adobe Audition. And thanks to Frame.io for their support of Art of the Cut and its pledge to keep this content coming your way. If this is a podcast that you got something out of, follow me and feel free to reach out to me on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Hallfish. And so you don't miss out on all the great upcoming interviews on the Out of the Cut podcast, subscribe to this podcast. And remember, if you have a friend in the film business or who aspires to be in the film business, make sure to tell them about the Out of the Cut podcast and blog.frame.io.